North Korea will send a top leader to the Winter Olympics. On Monday, state media said Pyongyang's ceremonial head of state, Kim Yong-nam, will attend the Games' opening ceremony this Friday in the South. It's an unprecedented move by the North. Kim will be the highest-ranking official to cross the border since the Korean War ended in 1953.
The Tesla Roadster gearing up to be the first car heading to outer space. The sports car will be carried aboard Elon Musk's new Falcon Heavy jumbo rocket, set to lift off from the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, on Tuesday. If the launch goes smoothly and succeeds, it will be the most powerful rocket to leave the United States since NASA's launch to the moon 45 years ago.
Asian markets tanking at the open on Tuesday as a frantic sell-off in equity markets on Wall Street becomes global. Japan's benchmark Nikkei plunged as much as 5.6%, its worst day in 15 months. In the rest of Asia, declines in shares fell further for a second day, the biggest drop in more than a year and a half.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's February 6, 2018, 5:10 in the morning. Glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. Front and center this morning are the markets and yesterday's Dow crash with the Dow off more than 1,100 points to end the day. World markets, as you heard there in the opening montage, reacting accordingly. We want to begin with that first, but on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, a quick snapshot now. Dow futures have recovered from their low, an implied open down almost 1,100 points at one point last night to just about 300 points. Now Dow futures have regained a lot of the ground that they've lost. As you heard in the opening montage, markets in Asia and in Europe are all significantly lower this morning. In Japan, down almost 5%. In Hong Kong as well. In Europe, markets down generally 1.5 to 2%. I want to bring in Paul Nolte first off this morning. Paul is with us from Kingsview Asset Management. Paul, is this the beginning of the correction that we were expecting or no?
I'm actually kind of hoping that it's the beginning of the end of the first leg. And what I mean by that is what we saw yesterday was really a sell anything, everything, don't ask questions, just get me out. And that created that air pocket, if you will, where we saw the S&P drop 3-4% inside of an hour near the close yesterday, and that certainly continued on overnight and saw the futures down another 600-700 points on the Dow, you know, close to another 100 points on the S&P. And as you mentioned, we've recovered. We're in positive territory. I think investors are holding their collective breath that we kind of hang here and maybe improve from here. What we see going forward is we'll get a bounce, and maybe this is the, like I said, the momentum bottom. We get a bounce. We will retest this then another couple of weeks from now, and we'll see what it looks like. And from there, hopefully resume the market rise. But this has certainly put the fear of investing back into investors where everybody was pretty confident that markets were going higher and all you had to do was just buy.
Paul, I know when we spoke last on Friday, and you have been cautious all along, but you suggested that we do take a little off the top, a little off the table. What is the action now or reaction to any of this that we as investors should take today?
Well, certainly net selling. Late yesterday for a few accounts where I had a little bit of cash, late in the day we did a little bit of buying in some mutual funds. But again, generally speaking, this is a good time to just sit back and watch. There's no need that you have to be investing today, tomorrow. Allow the markets to settle down, allow the dust to settle before you step back in. But that being said, it's not a bad idea to have a little bit of a shopping list together. Now, I liked Apple at 170, 175. It's down to 160 and change or below. You can use a lot of those types of examples that where some stocks have come down 10, 15, 20% even. that are still very good companies, still doing well on the revenue side, earnings side. So it's not a bad time to kind of put your shopping list together and take a look at the markets and be patient. This is not necessarily a time to rush in, nor certainly, in our view, a good time to be taking money off the table.
A lot of people are asking, whether or not this had anything to do with the jobs report last week, with inflation, with the new Federal Reserve chair, who was his first day yesterday. Any of those things have anything to do with this?
The jobs, I think, had something to do with it. But if you look at the reaction in the market, it's certainly an overreaction. And I think if there's a place that we can point to, it's maybe the volatility part of the market. And this is getting deep into the weeds, but there's an index called volatility, or the VIX index, and it measures how volatile the market is. Historically, that's been around 18, 19 or so on average. We have been down below 10 for quite a long time, and investors get very complacent about that very low volatility. When it started to return, there were an awful lot of investors that got caught investing in volatility, and we saw that go from 8 to over 40, and that created some big losses in some major parts of the market. And I think in that regard, that fed on itself. Certainly interest rates have gone up dramatically from Friday and are anticipating a lot more from the Fed than I think they will deliver in the way of rate hikes. We're still calling for 3. We haven't changed. And I think that's probably reasonable. They were starting to call for 4 after Friday's report, that we will see 4 more rate hikes. So, again, interest rates going up, but the very low volatility going away, a lot of those things contributed to the market decline. But certainly I think it was set off by the fear of higher wages, higher inflation. And I think, much like the decline here in the market, a lot of that is overblown right now. And we'll wait, like I said, we'll wait for a while for the dust to settle and see where things settle out.
All right. Paul, good information this morning. Let's hope today's a better day. Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. By the way, the VIX, the volatility index, yesterday jumped 116%, the highest daily percentage recorded in that index going back to 1990.
From ABC News Wall Street Now, stock watchers had been warning about a major correction, and yesterday it came. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 1,175 points, its biggest one-day drop ever, to close at 24,345. The S&P 500 skidded 113 points. The NASDAQ was down 273. Even as the tech-heavy NASDAQ fell, Apple stock rose about a percentage point. Analysts, though, are warning the electronics giant is facing challenges of its own. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 521. Were you watching the Super Bowl and all of the ads? Like most people, you probably were. This morning, we have Derek Rucker, who's a professor of marketing at Kellogg School of Management. And every year, the folks there and get together and look at all the ads and give them a grade. Derek, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I always gauge a commercial when I see it on the Super Bowl, whether I laugh out loud. Were there a lot of ads that did that, or what was the theme this year?
Yeah, so entertainment's certainly one value of them. I would say that, like, overall, this was a pretty safe year. You saw, like, brands tried to be funny, but no one tried to be too controversial. So brands played it pretty safe this year on the Super Bowl.
So what did you judge to be the top ad this year?
So the top overall ad, and this is a panel of our MBA students here at Kellogg, and they're trying to look at the ads, not just from that laugh-out-loud value that you said, the entertainment value, but whether strategically it made sense. Did it build the brand? Do you remember that as an ad for that brand as opposed to just a funny ad? And so our overall winner was Amazon's Alexa spot. And if you remember, this is the one that featured Alexa throughout the entire spot, but used very different voice actors to kind of articulate what would happen if Alexa lost her voice.
This one made me laugh out loud, so I'm in agreement with you guys on this one. Lots of money is spent on these ads, and it's important that we remember them. I guess that's what the advertisers would like us to believe, right?
Yeah, so this year, for 30 seconds, you're going to spend approximately $5 million just for the media buy. And you'd say, well, what should that $5 million do? It should increase memory. It should lead to attention to the brand, discussion about the brand, social media about the brand. So another brand that really killed it this year, I'm sure it got you laughing too, was Tide's It's Not a Tide ad.
Yes, it because of all of the different people that it brought into it, and it was just sort of a funny, hey, yeah, I'm wearing bright clothing kind of ad.
The Tide one.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But they kept reinforcing that point of, it's Tide, it's Tide. And so that's one where there people are talking on social, online, so you're getting more value for that money you're spending.
And that would be another question of mine, is how successful were these brands in tying in social media to all of this?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think some were much better than others. So I think Tide was one where they were actively engaged in social media. Other brands we saw were so quiet that they didn't get much buzz on the social media, even though they appeared in the Super Bowl. So, for example, brands like T-Mobile and Squarespace, we didn't see the same level of discussion happening.
So what would be some of the other commercials besides Tide and Amazon, the others that you've mentioned here, that really stand out to you guys?
Sure. I'll tell you one of the ones on the one more good one, and if you want, we can talk about some of the ones that kind of fell down. But the Avocados from Mexico ad. And so this one you might remember is the one where people were trapped in a bubble. They had guacamole, but they did not have chips, a dangerous combination, right, or lack of. And why this is a great ad, you'd say, so people laughed, they thought it was funny, but what the brand shows you is that it's okay, you don't have to have chips for guacamole, there are lots of things you can do with guacamole. When you're a big player in the category, like avocados from Mexico, what you're trying to do is increase category usage. So what they're essentially conveying is, there's lots of things to do with guacamole besides chips. So that's a sound strategy beyond just the entertainment value of the ad.
Yeah, it brings to mind avocado toast and that whole thing that we saw this past year going on.
Bingo.
Yeah. So who fell down? Who were the ads that fell down?
So let me talk about the two bottom ones. First one being Squarespace. So this is the one that featured Keanu Reeves riding a motorcycle. And the thing about that ad, I love Keanu. I love the work he did, The Matrix in particular. But that ad tells you almost nothing about the brand, what it does, how it executes, why you should use it relative to others. And so that's one where you showed up to the Super Bowl and people saw you, but a lot of them are probably scratching their heads and saying, so wait, what is that and why should I use it? And that's a dangerous way to spend $5 million.
When an ad like this fails, or when you see these companies at the bottom, what happens on Monday after this? So do they fire their ad reps, or what kind of conversations do you think goes on in those boardrooms?
It depends how bad it is, I think. So Squarespace is one where they've had this approach for a while, and my thought is they should really be talking with their agency and thinking of, is there a more strategic way they can get off this creative content? People have lost their jobs over Super Bowl ads, and so when a Super Bowl ad goes really bad, and by real bad, I mean not that you and I forget it as consumers, but we actually are offended by it. There certainly have been instances where the brand managers responsible have parted ways from the company.
Well, and funny you bring that up, because I think the one that everybody is, at least on my Twitter feed, still talking about is this Ram commercial featuring Martin Luther King's voice. That got a lot of blowback.
And that's the perfect example of the what's the worst outcome or worst case scenario is exactly that, where you and I spent money to produce that ad, millions of dollars, and instead of it having a great positive impact for our brand, instead of it simply failing to grab attention or be remembered, it's actually creating controversy and negativity around our brand. And so that's one a few years back was Nationwide, where they showed a kid who never grew up because he died, led to a very similar backlash. And so what Ram had done, I think it's an example of using a very powerful, iconic civil rights leader. And then when people take away from that, wait, and so you're just trying to use Martin Luther King's voice to sell me a truck? That really goes down poorly. And so it creates the worst case scenario for the spend of your money.
Yeah, and apparently using an ad piece of a speech that was actually against advertising, that was designed to be anti-advertising.
Yeah, the other, just as a similar approach was the Beatles Revolution song was once used in a Nike commercial, and that drew the ire of the Beatles, who said that was a powerful song about revolutions. It wasn't meant to be to sell shoes.
Right.
And I think that's where, as an advertiser, you have to be very careful about how you appropriate powerful cultural icons and imagery in your advertising.
Derek, this is another year where they had, we got to see a lot of these ads before the Super Bowl, and I think a lot of people went to look at them there. I hate that. I wish that would go away. I don't know how you guys feel about it, because every year your team makes this a big media event where we can't wait to see your scores and we can't wait to sit and watch the game. How does that hurt how we look at these ads?
Yeah, great question. So I'm very much like you, which is, I do not like seeing them beforehand because it basically ruins the moment, right? If you watch the football game at all, that would be like telling you there's going to be a great trick play and that's going to be a game changer. It's like, well, I want to see that live. I don't want to know it going in.
Yeah, absolutely.
You see brands do this for a reason, though. And so one sign is when a brand actually doesn't think it has a Super Bowl-worthy spot. And what I mean by that is it's not going to have a spot that will actually win on the Super Bowl. So it's not going to be like Tide or Amazon where it cuts through the clutter. You release early to get some of your value there, right? Which is, people won't remember me on the Super Bowl, so I'm going to go ahead and get out beforehand. The risk, though, is that once you get in the Super Bowl where you have that moment where you can shine and people can talk about you, they might go, oh yeah, that's that ad. So I think the better strategy, and we're seeing some brands adopt it, Avocados from Mexico certainly did this a little bit, is they will do teasers for what is to come without revealing the actual content of the ad. To me, that's the strategy that brands should think about going forward, because it gives you the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and then we have a reason to tune in and not to sit and do something else during the commercials. Derek,
exactly.
Good of you to be with us this morning. Great scoring as always, and we'll see you again next year.
My pleasure.
All right, Derek Rucker, professor of marketing at Kellogg School of Management. We're going to link out, too, to their grading of the advertising on the Super Bowl. Amazon, of course, winning the big 2018 Kellogg Super Bowl review this year.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Peapod, the Chicago-based online grocery pioneer, is expanding its meal kit service by adding to its line of ready-to-cook kits, including six new meal options. Peapod said its meal kits have seen a 104% increase in new customer purchases year over year. And the University of Chicago recently published a look at the 17 research and innovation milestones the university saw in 2017. They include an oil-soaking sponge and an expanded Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition. Despite considerable scientific evidence that shows later school start times are associated with more sleep among adolescents, as well as improvements in well-being, public safety, and even the overall economy, schools are still not on the bus with the idea of changing their school start times. Why is that? Wendy Traxel is a senior behavioral and social scientist at the nonprofit, nonpartisan RAND Corporation, and she's with us this morning. Wendy, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Most kids probably don't get up at the time that you and I are talking, in the 5 o'clock hour in the morning. They probably sleep in a little bit later than that. But there's a push that's underway to have school start a little bit later to fit their sleeping habits. Tell us about why this movement is out there, and is it gaining ground?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say there are actually plenty of teenagers who are having to wake up around the 5 o'clock hour, when you consider that many school buses start picking up around 6 a.m. or 6:20 a.m. So it's not actually that far off the realm of possibility. And the average school start time for teenagers in the U.S. is 8:03 a.m. Now, this is a real problem for teenagers because they're biologically driven to stay awake later and sleep in later. And so there has been a movement driven by scientific evidence showing that earlier school start times really are a public health problem for teenagers because they're chronically sleep deprived. So there's a movement towards delaying school start times for middle and high schools. And we've seen in recent years growing momentum for this movement across the country.
So what is the sweet spot in terms of time here? What the places that have gone to this, what time are they starting?
Sure. So there's actually great variability, and the best benchmark for this is what the medical professionals say. And the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Centers for Disease Control, and other major medical organizations have all recommended that middle and high schools start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. So that's really no earlier than. And so we're seeing schools that are making the change, some, you know, going as far as 8:30, some going later, some sort of inching towards the 8:30. The later, the better, though, frankly.
And so give us a sense of when you have kids that are, let's go with the earlier kids, the way it's always been done. What do we know about how hard it is for them to sort of kick in the learning part of their brain that early?
Sure. So just a little bit about the biology. What happens around the time of puberty is that kids' biological clocks are delayed by about 2 hours relative to adults or younger children. So they're really hormonally programmed to stay up later and sleep in later. And so when we have start times excessively early at 8 a.m. or earlier, as many schools are, we're waking them up hours before their biological clocks tell them they're ready. And it's not just that we can tell them to go to bed earlier, because they can't. For most teenagers, in order to get the recommended 8 to 10 hours of sleep per night that they need, and if you factor in the times of buses picking up in the morning, they'd need to be going to bed at 9 p.m., which is just biologically impossible. This is not just about good parenting. So what they're experiencing is everyday jet lag. You know, how you feel if you try to go, you might want to go to bed earlier if you change time zones, but you can't because your brain says it's not ready. And then you have to wake up hours before your brain is ready. So one of the consequences for learning is that about 1 in 5 teenagers fall asleep in class on a regular basis. This is a real threat to their ability to learn. But the truth is, the consequences go far beyond the classroom. It's a real public health epidemic.
And I want to talk a little bit about those. Goes all the way to the to impacting negatively the overall economy of the country.
Yes, this is some work that we did at the RAND Corporation, looking at the economic impacts of, you know, what a later start time could do. Because generally, when schools approach the topic of the consideration of delaying start times based on the scientific evidence, one of the major concerns is, oh, well, how much will this cost us if we have to change bus routes, et cetera? And nobody had really been looking at, well, wait a second, there might be some economic benefits if we improve the health, the safety, and the learning environment for students. And that's exactly what we found. An economic projection in a state-by-state analysis to look at how a delay in start times across the country to 8:30 or later could affect the U.S. economy. What we found that about over a 20-year period, the economic gains on average would be about $9.3 billion each year. That's roughly the annual revenue of Major League Baseball. So even though there may be some upfront costs, the benefits that we would accrue by the improved academic performance and graduation rates of students, as well as a reduction in car crashes among teenagers, which is also a major problem, would result in these substantial benefits to the economy.
Because the car crash is part of it. That's a sleepy kid going to school or coming home from school.
Exactly. And drowsy driving is, a major problem. And teenage new drivers are some of the most vulnerable individuals to be in drowsy driving accidents.
You mentioned earlier one of the arguments against this is that we always hear this. Well, this is about bad parenting. Parents should make their kids go to bed early. In addition to being a parent, you're also a sleep scientist. Why is that a bad argument?
Sure. I mean, I am a parent of a teenager, actually almost two teenagers, and I'm a sleep scientist. And so I absolutely believe in good parenting, and you better believe that I set rules in my household about no technology in the bedroom, about a consistent bedtime and wake-up time. But even so, I cannot fight my teenager's biology. I know the science, and I know that asking him to go to bed at 9 p.m. is really physiologically impossible for him. So, you know, as with many public health epidemics, like we see with the obesity epidemic, it's not a single bullet strategy that's going to solve the problem. We need multi-pronged strategies. And later school start times are the one policy that intervention that evidence has shown could make a demonstrable impact on reducing the epidemic of teen sleep deprivation. So we need good parenting and we need good policy.
We talked earlier about the economic part of this, $9 billion potential put back into the economy. On the flip side of that, what would schools be out here? It seems to me that it wouldn't cost them anything because they're just really shifting the services that they already provide.
So it doesn't actually, you're right, it doesn't always mean that there are costs involved in a delayed school start time. Our economic projections were really very conservative based on higher cost estimates relative to the benefits. And the costs generally for most school districts are accrued based on having to change bus schedules. So, for instance, most schools or many schools have a three-tier bus system, and with middle and or high schools generally going first, middle perhaps going second, and elementary going the latest, which biologically is really the opposite of what you would want because it's the teenagers who have this biological delay, whereas elementary students naturally wake up early. So our cost projections were based on the sort of most expensive option, which would be to switch busing tiers from a three-tier to a two-tier, so you have less of a time interval between each of the tiers when you release the buses, and it may also mean purchasing more buses. That's not to say that every school district even has to spend those, purchase more buses. So we just wanted conservative costs relative to the benefits that we calculated based on the improved academic performance and the reduction in car crash rates.
What are you
finding? It really will vary school district to school district.
Sure. What are you finding about how many school districts have actually tried this and what have they reported?
So it's very, very difficult to track an actual number of how many school districts have made the change because, in fact, this is a very dynamic sort of process, and not every school will report that they've made a delayed start time. What I can say is just by the media attention alone, we're seeing more and more reports of school districts across the country, big and small, who have made the change, everything from Seattle Public Schools to Fairfax County Public Schools in Virginia, two of the largest school districts in the country, and then many smaller schools in between, both rural and urban. They've all made the change. And the science that has developed so far, actually, there's about 30 years of science on this topic, beginning in a school district in Minnesota, showing strong benefits of later start times in terms of students' likelihood to show up for school, to stay in school, to graduate from school, improved learning, and also other mental and physical health benefits as well.
As we're talking here, I'm imagining being a high school student who generally is an okay student, struggling every day, and then realizing that maybe it's something completely out of my control because of the sleep issue.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard.
You know, what we're seeing today with today's generation, and again, I'm not saying that this is the only factor. Technology is also a big problem with teenagers today. But what we are seeing today is rising rates, epidemic rates, of major mental health issues like depression, anxiety, and suicide. And I can tell you that the science clearly demonstrates that sleep deprivation is a preventable risk factor for these really catastrophic, potentially mental health outcomes in teenagers. So if we really want to support the health and well-being of our teenagers and set them up for success, we've got to have learning environments and school schedules that support their opportunity to get some adequate sleep.
Where would be a good place for parents who are interested in more about this go? Where's a good resource for them to learn more about this?
Sure. So there are a number of resources that they can access online. There is a nonprofit organization called StartSchoolLater.net that has a number of good resources. Our RAND report is available online. If you search for Economics of Later School Start Times or RAND, there's a number of resources that can point you in the direction of the solid scientific evidence supporting later start times, also the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation and the Centers for Disease Control all have statements issued about the importance of later school start times for teenagers.
We're going to link out to some of that. Wendy, do you have any advice as a parent on how to cut off some of this technology and sort of have that part of it put into place?
Absolutely, because, again, I do believe that in order to really make a dent in this problem, we've got to have multi-pronged strategies, and it does start in the home. Parents should make bedrooms media-free zones, and that includes for the parents because our children are watching us. So if you're going to be using technology in your bedroom, guess what? You're more likely to have a teenager who will use technology, iPhones, et cetera, in the bedroom. So get technology out of the bedroom and try to have a limit of no phone use, et cetera, within ideally 2 hours and at least an hour before bedtime.
Wendy, good information. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. I appreciate you having me.
Wendy Troxell is a senior behavioral and social scientist at the nonprofit nonpartisan RAND Corporation. You can follow her on Twitter at Wendy Troxell.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures now negative again off 251 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower. The VIX volatility index is up as well this morning at 46, which is up almost 24% over its low yesterday. Also, just to give you a little sense of what has happened over the last 4 days or so with world markets, including the U.S. markets nosediving, estimates now are that at least $4 trillion has been wiped off of the trade over the last several days, dating back to about Friday, with markets now around the world negative, some by as much as 4% in Tokyo this morning. Now, let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, Monday, starting the trading week, nothing but red on all of my market sheets, from grains to livestock to Wall Street. Wheat futures fell to a one-week low yesterday. Technical selling and an improving weather outlook, including beneficial moisture in parts of the Midwest winter wheat belt. Soybean futures set a two-week low on forecasts for much-needed moisture in parts of Argentina, and corn sagged as well. So a quick rundown of the red numbers. March wheat down 4¾ cents. March corn down 2¾ cents. And March soybeans down 8½ cents for the day yesterday. Livestock, well, the picture pretty much the same, because Mercantile Exchange live cattle futures yesterday finished lower for the first time in three sessions, thanks to profit-taking and continued heavy stock market losses. People were just watching what happened with stocks over the past few days and decided they wanted out of everything and figure it all out later, according to one trader. The live cattle futures traders are also waiting for this week's cash cattle prices in the plains. And the prices yesterday on the nearbys, we saw the April lean hog contract down 22 cents a hundredweight, February live cattle down 85 cents, and March feeder cattle down $1.32 a hundredweight. That's bad news Monday in the markets. But today, have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Tuesday, February 6th. We'll see a report on international trade today. Also, the job opening and labor turnover survey comes out. Only one Fed president speaking today, James Bullard, is out and about. Today, earnings from Disney, Snap, Archer Daniels Midland, General Motors, Dunkin' Branch, and Chipotle, just some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, February 6th.